During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk about the problem of healthcare uninsurance and what a solution might look like. Our guest is Dr. Shoshana Sofer, professor of healthcare policy in the School of Public Affairs at Baruch College, City University of New York. She's also a member of the Committee on the Consequences of Uninsurance of the Institute of Medicine, a part of the National Academies. Her group has just issued a report entitled Insuring America's Health, Principles and Recommendations. The report documents the growing number of uninsured Americans and the impact the lack of access to healthcare has on many lives. And it proposes five principles for eliminating uninsurance to guide reform efforts. The group declares that it is time now to extend coverage to all, and we'll talk about that during this hour of Focus 580. As we talk with Dr. Sofer, we invite you into the conversation. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana. The number to use, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, anywhere actually in the U.S. if you're listening online. That toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Your questions on this topic are welcome during this hour. Dr. Shoshana Sofer has been a member of the School of Public Affairs at Baruch College since 1998. She previously held academic positions at George Washington University Medical Center and the UCLA School of Public Health. She completed her Master's of Public Health and Doctor of Public Health degrees at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health, specializing in health planning, policy, and management. She received her undergrad degree from Barnard College, Columbia University in Government, and at the School of Public Affairs, Dr. Sofer teaches courses in healthcare policy, including community-based health planning, health policy, and evaluation of healthcare policies and programs. And Dr. Sofer also chaired the subcommittee responsible for this particular report. She joins us this morning by telephone. Dr. Sofer, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Just to start, I think those of us who have health insurance find ourselves feeling pretty lucky, even if the healthcare system isn't perfect, compared with all those who have, as you put it, uninsurance.
Right.
Who is uninsured?
Well, there are currently, as of last count, about 43.8 million Americans who were uninsured for all or part of the year, as we measure it today, which is a very kind of stringent measurement. And those people, there's a lot of myths about who they are, and they're quite different from who people think they are. The first important point to make is that these people are people who are working. 80% of those who are uninsured live in a family where at least one member of the family is working at least part-time. So we're talking about people who are working. They are, however, primarily in low-wage jobs, which is one explanation for why their employers are not providing them with health care coverage, because at that salary rate, adding an insurance cost onto it is really an extraordinary addition to one's compensation package.
Mm-hmm.
So they are working, however, mostly in low-wage jobs. Their household family incomes are normally under the 200% of what we call the federal poverty level. And so these are really the working poor. So that's who they are. In addition, although the majority of people with uninsurance are whites, there is a disproportionate share, as it were, of uninsurance among people of color, and in particular Latinos, and that's in part because of the kind of work they do, where they work. And they're sort of, in some ways, it's their work ethic that can get them in trouble, because they often are in a situation where they're working overtime just to make ends meet, and so they get above that rate at which they might be eligible for some kind of public program.
Mm-hmm. So it's really the people, not the extreme poor, but the people who are working.
Well, there are extreme poor among the uninsured, that's for sure. But that is not the predominant group, and these are definitely people who are working. And what's really interesting to me as I looked at these numbers is that, they pay out of their own pocket about altogether over the course of a year over $30 billion a year for healthcare services out of their own pocket. So these are not people who I would characterize as deadbeats.
Mm-hmm. We'll get back to dollars and how, you know, the system essentially, you know, dollars in some places are less efficient than others, obviously. I want to talk about that, certainly. I also wanted to ask, though, while we're talking about who are the uninsured, is there a geographic distribution? Is it universal across the 50 states?
It actually is not universal across the 50 states. There is some variation across those states. I was actually just looking at a map we have, and in Illinois, at the last count in 2002, 15.9% of the population were uninsured. That is the population that are under age 65. Above 65 and older, we have the Medicare program that really works for the 99.5% of Americans. So we're looking primarily at a problem faced by people who are under 65. So the range is actually quite wide, from the low point of 8.8% in the state of Minnesota to over 28% in the state of Texas. Mm-hmm. And in general, we do find that the states on our southern border, California, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, Florida, those states tend to have very high levels of uninsurance. And that, in part, is because of the nature of their economies.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned $30 billion uninsured people spend on health care. And in the report, you mentioned that people without health care insurance pay about 35% of their medical bills themselves.
Right. That's correct.
Who pays for the rest?
Well, actually, Jack, we do. The vast majority of the additional funds are paid for by a variety of programs and systems that are very, very complicated, very arcane, and that come out of either directly or indirectly, either federal, state, or local tax dollars. This ranges from federally funded community health centers that are across the country. But that also includes state funding for what are called indigent care programs, and also local funding. So our local public hospitals, for example, and local public health clinics are providing a lot of care for these folks.
Mm-hmm. We have a call to talk with, and I have more questions myself, but I will defer to listeners if you'd like to join us.
Sure.
And once again, we're talking with Dr. Shoshana Sofer, and she is on this committee of the Institute of Health looking at the problem of uninsurance. We're talking about their report that was recently published about the problem of healthcare uninsurance. And we're welcoming your questions, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. First up, a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. You know, I guess when it comes to nationalized healthcare, there's just no end to the complexities and to the fights. And I guess my main question, very simple, and it is, do we have the economic resources to, you know, promote a national health care plan? And if we do, could you just provide a few bullet points?
Okay, I want to make a distinction between nationalized health insurance and having an insurance strategy which achieves universal coverage. That kind of strategy does not have to be what some people call a single-payer system. It certainly doesn't have to be the kind of plan that exists in Great Britain, where the government actually runs the healthcare delivery system. It can really build on the existing foundation that we have of the 85% of our population who are insured right now. So we don't have to tear our system apart in order to achieve this. I think it's important for people to know that. But let's talk about how much it's going to cost. And let me give you a little bit of perspective on that. We estimated the cost not of a new expansion program so much, but of simply what would it cost to provide to people who are uninsured the healthcare services that they do not now get compared to people like them who are insured. And our estimates were that that cost would range from $34 billion to $68 billion. I hate having to talk in these billion kind of terms, but that's the way it is. That's a lot of money, right? That is a lot of money.
Sure.
But I want to tell you that that is about half of the increase that we experienced, just the normal increase that we experienced in healthcare costs between the year 2000 and the year 2001. Okay, so we are not talking about something which is going to break the bank in terms of additional resources. The other thing that we learned, which was very startling to me personally, and I've been working on this stuff for a long time, is that we lose a lot of value in terms of people being uninsured.
Mm-hmm.
And we calculated that the economic value lost to people who are uninsured ranges from, depending on how you calculate it, about $69 billion to about $130 billion. So we're really talking about the fact that we are really right now in a situation where the society as a whole is losing out economically because of this problem of uninsurance. Now, let me just make a caveat here. The issue is not just a matter of what the total dollar number is. It's a matter of where those dollars come from and who those dollars go to. And the politics that gets pretty ugly around this issue really have more to do with those distributive effects than I believe that they really have to do with the actual cost. People use the actual cost as their political argument,
mm-hmm.
but it really isn't how much it's going to cost, but who is it going to cost, and who's going to be getting perhaps fewer revenues and fewer profits because of the strategy that we use.
Well, I want to emphasize this area of the conversation because I think it's a really interesting one. We're always, you know, as you say, sort of rounding the numbers up without recognizing where those numbers impact people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's one thing to say, well, uninsured people pay 35% of their medical bills themselves, and communities and states and the rest of us pay the remaining 65%. But that's not the only cost. I mean, there are other costs when
right.
someone doesn't have, you know, access to health care, and it's not just lost work time, it's family impacts, it's community impacts.
Yes, and it's also death, to put it really bluntly. We calculated that there are 18,000 deaths in this country every year because people are uninsured, and that's because people who are uninsured do not get access to all the care that they need. I'm not just talking about all the care that they want. Americans are pretty profligate in many ways in their use of health care, and we believe that more is better and more expensive is even better than that. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about the kind of care that really does make a difference in one's health outcomes, in whether one gets well, in whether one is able to participate in, you know, productively in society in any way, shape, or form. And we're talking about 18,000 lives plus a lot of what we call morbidity. A lot of people who are sick who don't have to be. A lot of children whose life trajectories are not going to be as productive because in their early years they're not getting the preventive services they need. They're not getting the sort of quick care for things that can be nipped in the bud early. But if you don't nip them in the bud, they're going to get worse and worse and more costly.
Mm-hmm.
So we are really losing out on a human dimension. You mentioned families, and another subcommittee of the full committee that I served on talked about how health insurance really is a family matter. And there are over 60 million Americans who live in a family where at least one person goes without insurance. We've done a better job of insuring children right now because of the state children's health insurance program.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, we're not insuring their parents. And what we've learned is that the children whose parents are uninsured are often not taking advantage of the insurance they have, or they're not enrolling in insurance programs for which they're eligible because the parents aren't insured. And if the parents aren't insured and if the parents get sick, that diminishes their ability to take care of the family. Now, let's reverse that for a moment. I have lots of friends whose children are reaching their 20s right now. And at that point, an interesting thing happens. Those kids graduate from college, and they are no longer eligible for their family's health insurance coverage, okay? We're not talking here about working-class families. We're talking here about upper-middle-class families whose children are just going into the labor market. As a group just going into the labor market, they, too, might not be insured through their work, or they may be in graduate school, and working for somebody like me as a graduate assistant who isn't making sure that their graduate assistant has health insurance. I, however, do make sure with my graduate assistants. What's going on here is that we have the children of a very affluent family who, as one woman told me, she's using her her child's health insurance policy is their Visa card. So we have to understand that the family in America goes beyond the household, so that there's emotional problems, there can be bankruptcy issues, even when just one member of the family is uninsured. Because Americans, and this is a wonderful thing about our country, family doesn't stop at the door. You know, we have, you know, extended families that we feel a sense of obligation to in this as in many other areas.
Certainly. We have another call to talk with. Let's include another conversation. Let me just, again, reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Dr. Shoshana Sofer, professor of healthcare policy, School of Public Affairs, Baruch College, City University of New York, member of the Committee on the Consequences of Uninsurance of the Institute of Medicine. They just issued a report entitled Insuring America's Health, Principles and Recommendations. We'll talk in more detail about those principles and recommendations, but also welcome your questions. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Next up, someone in Crystal Lake on line number 4. Good morning.
I agree with her quite a bit. She's really intelligent and very knowledgeable. I just want to add, I want to remind people, in the Multinational Monitor, it says that with the money we spend, sending our insurance money to private insurance companies and HMOs, we could save, if we just had the government collect the money and distribute it, use our own doctors and hospitals, that we could save $209 billion a year. And this could, instead of funding administrative bureaucracy and the CEOs that make millions for salaries, we could have insurance that would fully cover the 41 million uninsured and upgrade coverage for the tens of millions underinsured, plus fully cover the senior drug cost. By saving that $209 billion instead of having the government collect and distribute the money, we would be paying only a third of what we pay now, people that are presently working, and the same money that's been going into private insurance companies, HMOs, would instead be just not having a profit margin. And this would help, like Canadians do, say, let us live 2 years longer, and that would... It would just be a single distributor of insurance funds instead of funding the lavish salaries of the administration of private insurance companies.
I think we take your point. Let's get a opportunity for the guests to respond.
Well, I take your point. I hear what you're saying. We did look at what we call a single payer option as one prototype of a solution that we could implement. But I have to tell you that what we really need to be doing as we move forward in trying to achieve this end is that we don't get wedded too early to a single solution as the only answer to this question. What a colleague of mine said is that we have to develop in this nation an appetite to actually solve this problem and to be committed to the solution, to getting it solved rather than to having this particular solution versus another particular solution come into play. I don't mean to in any way undermine what you've just said, but we really need to have a debate, a conversation, a dialogue in this country and try to see how we can come to some consensus. Because you mentioned at the beginning of the show, Jack, the 10-year-old Clinton health care reform plan, and I participated in that process. And one of the things that I would have to say about it was that there was very little willingness to be flexible, very little willingness to compromise. And another colleague, Stuart Altman, has said that very often in these debates, everybody's second favorite solution is to do nothing. And I think we can't afford that. We have to have doing nothing be the last solution. So I don't know exactly what the solution needs to be or can be or is going to be politically feasible. I just know we have to have one.
Well, I think that your committee has taken a very interesting approach to this in, as you say, not recommending a specific solution to say, well, it's got to be a single-payer system like Canada has or whatever, but rather has laid out a series of principles that any policy that truly does the job would have to be measured by.
Right.
And maybe we could talk about some of those now because we're almost at our midpoint and I want to make sure that we do that.
Yeah.
The first of which is that healthcare coverage should be truly universal.
Truly universal. That's the most important principle. and one of the struggles that we had in terms of thinking this issue through is that there has been a history in our country of people trying to make what we call incremental change. That's what's popular in that country, to do things incrementally. In the mid-60s, when we passed the Medicare and Medicaid programs, those were big increments. I wouldn't call that a purely incremental solution.
Mm-hmm.
Those programs really made a big difference. I shudder to think where'd we be now without them. But we have also seen a lot of things to start fix one tiny part of the problem. And Jack, the problem is those don't get it. They don't get it. So we came out that we said we have to have universal coverage, and it has to be continuous. We cannot have the kind of thing that we have even with some of our existing programs like Medicaid, where because of this need for people to be continuously reassessed to see whether or not they still meet the requirements, they're going on and off this program on a constant basis. And because of that, they don't maintain really a good continuous healing relationship with somebody in the healthcare system, and their health suffers. So that was the second principle. The third principle is that this has to be affordable to individuals and families. We cannot expect people to be paying vast sums of their limited incomes just on health insurance. We got to do the math here. The average cost of a family policy in the U.S. today is $7,000 a year. That's
mm-hmm.
average.
Mm-hmm.
Where I live in New York City, it's going to be more like $10,000 to $12,000 a year. That's pretty scary. And we're talking about people here who are making $25,000 a year, $30,000 a year before taxes, before that, 12.5% hit for Social Security and Medicare, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot expect people to be paying that whole burden themselves, so it's got to be affordable, and it's got to be affordable and sustainable for society. The strategy cannot break the bank. We don't want to be, wasting our money on this. And last but not least, we've got to have the kind of strategy that gives people access to really high-quality care, and that means not too little, and it also means not too much, and it means the right things at the right times.
Mm-hmm.
So those are our five principles.
Well, we're at our midpoint here, so let me just take a moment again to reintroduce our guest and invite listeners into the conversation. We're talking with Dr. Shoshana Sofer. She's professor of healthcare policy, School of Public Affairs, Baruch College, City University of New York. And we're talking about a report entitled Ensuring America's Health, Principles and Recommendations, recently issued by the Institute of Medicine. And Dr. Sofer is a member of the Committee on the Consequences of Uninsurance, which produced the report. And we're talking about its recommendations and possible ways to get to that solution on healthcare insurance in the United States. If you have questions or comments, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. We have a toll-free line also, anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. One of the things that has, I'm sure, been studied to within an inch of its life is where the actual dollars flow in the healthcare system.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's something that, I mean, as you looked at the problems in maybe solutions in healthcare insurance, in what detail did you look at that, and does that lead us to answers?
Well, I think that we looked specifically at where money comes from to pay for the services that the uninsured already received.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I mentioned earlier, that's coming from two major places. The bulk of the money is actually coming from federal, state, and local tax dollars in a variety of indirect, direct, and highly arcane ways. the second big source of that money are the pockets of the uninsured themselves. Now, in terms of where the overall dollars go to, we did not look at that. We didn't think of that as being part of our mandate. We know that overall within the healthcare delivery system, a very substantial chunk of money goes to care for people in hospitals. And then another very big chunk of money goes to care for people in doctors' offices, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A growing percentage of money goes for prescription medications. And that's both in some ways and this is my personal opinion, the good news and the bad news. It's the bad news because in part it reflects the higher prices that we seem to be paying for a lot of the newer medications. But on the other hand, we also have to recognize that sometimes if you can have a prescription drug solution to a problem, that's a lot cheaper
mm-hmm.
than, for example, a surgical solution, and it's certainly a lot cheaper than no solution at all. So it isn't so much a matter of where the money is going. It's a matter of the fact that we just have this group of people who are not tied to any system that makes sure that they have health care coverage and health care access.
We have a couple calls to include in our conversation. Let's do that. We'll go next to a listener in Urbana on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I'm calling with a question about medical savings insurance. Isn't that an option some people have now to have a sort of a bank account where they can save money for medical reasons? And I'm not even quite sure about what is involved with this, but I thought...
Right.
Yeah.
The medical savings account is an idea that has become popular in kind of two contexts. One is what we call cafeteria plan benefits that people get from their employers. And there are some people that are being offered a kind of account that gives them what you would call an opportunity, say, to sort of have the employer contribute a certain amount of money to their insurance, and then they can use that money to pay for healthcare services. And then after a certain point, they have what we call the hole in the donut, where there's all of a sudden a very, very large deductible that they have to pay out of their own pocket before they get insured again. The medical savings account idea in its purest form has been something that's been talked about a lot for people who are for people with Medicare. So that just as we have IRAs that we use to save for retirement, the suggestion is we'd have medical savings accounts that we could use to save for health care during retirement or maybe even before retirement. Again, I think what we've got to be realistic about is that those kinds of accounts are probably a very good deal for people who are healthy and wealthy and not necessarily a good deal for people who are either not healthy or not wealthy. It's just it is a very, very hard thing to make work for people who are in that sort of circumstance.
Well, I suppose my question is, I'm a graduate student, and I'll be leaving the university soon, and I'm having a baby, and I won't be on their insurance much longer, and I wondered, what can I do sort of in between? I expect that, yes, I'll get a job, that's the hope,
mm-hmm.
one that will help me, with insurance, but I wondered if something like the medical savings insurance would be a good start for the in-between time.
Well, what I think is parallel to that is what you might call a catastrophic coverage kind of insurance, where there is a very, very high deductible, so there's consequently a lower premium. But I do want to let you know that even when you leave the university, you do have, through a law that's called COBRA, an opportunity to continue to buy into your university's group policy, but you have to pay 102% of the cost, 100% plus 2% for them to manage it for you. And in that circumstance, few people take advantage of that, except if they're sort of out of work for a very short period of time and they want to be sure they're covered for, a month or two. It's there, but, you should find out, which most Americans don't, how much the total cost of your current health care coverage is and what it would become if you also had a child. You're going to face a situation where, because you're known to be pregnant, a private insurer, not your university, would say, well, your pregnancy is a pre-existing condition and therefore we won't cover it even if you buy insurance from us. So, I'm sorry to say that you're between something of a rock and a hard place here, and your best bet is, as the old song of the 60s used to say, is get a job, and get a job with health insurance coverage, because you really do land in one of the demographic groups, the young adults, who are more likely to be uninsured.
Well, if only it was that easy. Let's hope it is, but thank you so much.
All right, thanks for the call, and good luck. Well, we have a couple of the callers. Let's include them. Next, listener in Urbana again, line number two. Good morning. Is there a caller there?
Yeah, hello?
Yes.
I thought it was line number three, but what about the issue of preventive care? Has any research been done on that in terms of what the savings would be?
There have been attempts to do savings on preventive care, and I think that the evidence is really strong about the importance of various kinds of preventive clinic, what we call clinical preventive services. If we sort of switch things, you can see that the greatest cause of death in the United States right now is smoking, and there's a very, very high cost that we incur for people smoking. If you can catch certain diseases early, through screening exams, that is often, not always, but often very cost-effective. And unfortunately, our system has taken a while to get this idea, and it's only really now that the vast majority of people who even have health insurance are likely to have good coverage for those preventive services. And what we also found is that the uninsured are much less likely to get those preventive services. And that's really a tragedy, because they're going to be paying for it, and we're going to be paying for it. Here's the sort of the bullet point that you can use, which is that if we don't find out that you have hypertension, or if your diabetes isn't well managed, then you may be subject to getting something called end-stage renal disease. Well, hello, once you get end-stage renal disease, you're covered by the Medicare program. Mm-hmm. But at that point, your costs are astronomical.
Well, even in the case of Medicare, does not have preventive.
Yes, Medicare is beginning to get on board with covering preventive services. However, what I really worry about is people that are my age, who we sometimes rudely call the near elderly, people in the 50 to 64 age group. And when those folks are uninsured, it means that they are very often bringing into the Medicare program with them a lot of unmet health care needs because they haven't been insured.
What was sort of humorous was that recently this promotion about Medicare, and I don't know, there was some criticism in terms of political, that they can actually get when you first come into it, you actually get a health exam. And I thought this was pretty humorous. Once in your whole life you get a health exam, you know. You know, in terms of the idea of
and let me tell you that getting a health exam is actually within the last 5 years.
Oh yeah, no, but I just think it's sort of humorous that one time, you know, it's not preventive, and it'd be interesting if somebody could really put the numbers together of whatever the cost to society, and it's got to cost a fortune.
Yes, yes, you know. It does, and it costs a fortune in money, and it costs a fortune in lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in family disruption.
And again, I'm not trying to get away from your issue, you know, which was one that should have been resolved.
Well, I would not say that we have a committee on the consequences of uninsurance that is not concerned about the issue of preventive services, and I certainly am not. I'm very, very deeply concerned about it because it makes sense any way you look at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We have just about maybe 12 minutes left with our guest, Shoshana Sofer, professor of healthcare policy, School of Public Affairs, Baruch College, City University of New York. And we're talking about a report of a committee that she is the chair of. The report is entitled Insuring America's Health, Principles and Recommendations, looking at the problem of healthcare uninsurance in America. And we have several callers waiting. Time for others, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number three. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. Yeah, you kind of alluded to this earlier, but the real problem, as I see it, with the single payer idea is that it's so threatening to the health insurance and pharmaceutical companies that they will spend billions and billions and billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars, to make sure that it never happens, because they would see that as basically, with the health insurance putting them out of business and the pharmaceutical companies cutting deeply into their outrageous profits. What do you think about that?
Well, what I would like to say is that there are other ways besides single payer that we can use to achieve universal coverage. In our committee, we looked at four prototypes that ranged what you could call the sort of ideological span from the kind of thing that more conservative Americans would be quite comfortable with, to the kind of thing that is sort of on the other end of the spectrum, which is characterized by the single-payer solution. I think your analysis is got a lot of merit to it. I can tell you that in terms of the Clinton plan, if you folks are old enough to remember the Harry and Louise ads, which were run on TV to discourage support, those were from the Health Insurance Association of America. And so I think you're probably correct, but what I want you to be aware of is that there are a whole lot of other methods that can be used that include expansions of existing public programs combined with tax credits for individuals, premium subsidies for low-wage employers, all kinds of things. And we looked at four of these prototypes, and every one of them does a significantly better job than the system that we have in place today. So the issue is not, can we do it? The issue is, will we do it?
Well, you know, the problem I had with the Clinton health care plan is it seemed like it was, you know, despite the protests of the health insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies, it seemed like a method designed to pump more money into them rather than, you know, doing something that made health care actually more affordable. And I guess, you know, one of the acid tests for me of any system would be that, you know, it wasn't just a way of siphoning money out of people's pockets and, you know, increasing the profits of the private insurance mm-hmm. and pharmaceutical companies.
I think you're right. I think one of the things that we've got to be very conscious of is that we now spend $1.5 trillion a year on healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you spend $1.5 trillion, that means that somebody's are out there, and that's revenue for them. It's expenditures for us. It's revenues for them, okay? So if they feel like they're going to be losing out on revenues, they're going to make it known. And that's what our political system lets them do, and I'm glad that our political system does let them do it, but we have to find a way to kind of get beyond that, and we have to find a way to say, this is something that is hurting not just people who are uninsured, it's hurting all of us, because it is reducing our economic productivity as a nation, because, in fact, there are a lot of parts of our healthcare system that are not operating even for the insured population because of this problem. If you have, God forbid, a brain trauma injury and you go to your local emergency room, you rush to your local emergency room, you might not find that there is a neurosurgeon on call there, which is what you need to deal with that problem, okay? The reason the neurosurgeon is not there is because that person does not want to have to deal with taking care and providing very expensive care to people coming through the emergency room who are without insurance. So they take themselves off what's called on call. That means they're not available not just for the uninsured, they're not available for anybody. So we've got a real problem here, and we've got to try to see whether or not we can get past these politics and also recognize that the cost of health care is a very, very serious problem, and that we are likely not to be able to solve the entire cost problem in health care as we solve the problem of the lack of insurance. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but we may not get the whole way there at the same time that we're trying to solve the problem of insurance. I think Americans also need to start to say, why are we paying more than every other country in the developed world?
Well, I absolutely agree. That's the point I was going to make, is that we are paying more than anybody else, and yet we don't necessarily have better outcomes than a lot of other countries.
We don't have better outcomes on almost all the major indicators.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. Our lines are all full. We'll go on next to a listener who's been waiting patiently on line number 4, someone on a cell phone. Good morning. You're on Focus 580. Hello?
Yeah, hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm currently paying about $1,000 a month for health insurance just on myself,
mm-hmm,
with a $5,000 deductible.
Mm.
And since this 9/11 issue that our country had to face, it's like my insurance has went up like $600 a month since then. And it's just like, where's it all going to end? And I am self-employed, and I'm trying to maintain and do all this, but I know there's a lot of other people out here that's in the same boat that I am, and we're all facing the dilemma of whether we keep on paying this,
mm-hmm,
or do we start dropping out and hope for the best, or what, because the cost is just getting... it's just getting astronomical here, that even being self-employed, it's just getting out of hand that we can't even afford this. You know, although we really want to keep it, you know, it's just starting to get out of hand. I don't know if these insurance companies are just gouging the heck out of us or what the heck's going on. I don't know. Maybe somebody could touch base on some of this or something.
Okay.
Well, there are so many drivers of cost in the healthcare system that I don't even know where to begin. Obviously, there are the costs of insurance, of administering insurance, and most insurance companies are for profit, and they do make profit, or they try to make profit anyway, and they try to cost out their policies on the basis of actuarial calculations, okay? One of the reasons you might be paying more than the average person is because you are buying it as an individual, and because that means that you're a risk pool of one. And if you're not exactly 25 and not exactly a person who's never had a health problem before in your life, every one of those things is going to raise the price and raise the price. And you're absolutely right. At a certain point, it really becomes unaffordable. But I think we also have to recognize that there are other drivers of cost, and those include the fact that the actual cost of the services that we're getting is pretty high. For an average service, we pay more than in an awful lot of countries. And in addition to that, we tend to want the best, the newest, and what we think of as the best is the newest and the most expensive. It isn't always. If you talk to the purchasers who pay for these, we also know that a lot of healthcare is being provided to people in this country which is what we would call inappropriate. People don't necessarily need that health care, or they could have gotten the same or a better outcome using something less expensive. So you're absolutely right. We do have to get a handle on this. But in doing so, I think it's a mistake to demonize anybody. I think there's more than enough blame to go around. And we really need to have to figure out the way that we've got our system set up, which is that nobody really, except somebody like your caller, takes it in the chops as an individual because of these high prices.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we're all paying, but it doesn't feel like it. And I really would recommend that each and every one of your listeners find out what, if they are insured, and if they're getting insurance coverage through their employer, find out not just what they're paying, but what the employer is paying as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hear in the voice of the caller a great deal of frustration.
Yes.
And part of that seems to be not being able to understand how this is constructed. It seems very complicated. And I think that, you know, we talked about, you know, the intersection between private insurance and Medicare when you reach a certain age, and the gaps that exist between various segments of demographics and people's different situations. And, you know, the Clinton plan was, people complained that it was very complicated. Well, the system we have now is very complicated.
Yeah. I think that everybody said, We used to say complicated compared to what? You know, compared to what we've got now, is unbelievably complicated and getting more complicated as we speak. You know, with each piece of, we have a new acronym every week for some kind of insurance plan or some kind of new treatment. I mean, in part, it's a reflection of our incredible creativity as a nation. But some of that creativity is creativity in how to make a buck and not necessarily creativity in how to have a more effective healthcare system. We've got a lot of work to do on the healthcare system, both in terms of its quality and in terms of its cost. It is very complicated. And part of the reason that it's complicated is because Americans really do fear having a lot of power vested in one small group of institutions, whether or not that's a public set of institutions or a private set of institutions. We get nervous when things get too big.
We have a couple calls to talk with and maybe just about 6 minutes left, so we'll try to be quick here. We'll go next to a listener on line number one in Champaign. Good morning. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, that's you. Hi, I hear you.
Hi, yes, okay.
Go ahead.
My question, and this goes back to a point that that was just made, and I wanted to ask about the failure of the COBRA program, which is supposed to be one of the programs to help people stay insured, but most people don't realize, because of the high cost of both, you know, employee and employer contributions to premiums, how expensive it is to actually stay insured once you get laid off.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have I know two people right now who have been laid off, both have chronic illnesses, and can't maintain COBRA because their payments are $600 and $800, and they're only receiving about $1,200 in unemployment.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about who exactly this program is designed to benefit and how it, you know, what kind of effect it's really had on keeping people on insurance?
Well, I think it's had a very small effect. I think you're absolutely right. I think there are a small number of people who, as I said earlier, are likely to be people who are going to be uninsured for a very short period of time, who, especially if, like your friends, have a chronic illness that they know about, they'll go into the hole just to be able to keep that that coverage until they get over into the next job. But I think that to think of COBRA as a realistic solution for people who are unemployed is pretty silly, quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems
not,
like a public relations
again,
plan
right.
for the government that really hasn't had any real solutions.
Well,
here's
what we've got to do. And when people start talking about incremental solutions, you've got to ask how much of an increment are we talking about here.
Right.
This was supposedly a little incremental solution. The Health Insurance Portability Act was another little incremental solution. And they don't work.
Yeah.
They don't work because they're trying to take care of a micrometer thin slice of the group who are uninsured. And usually they're trying to do it with little or no cost. I mean, really nobody pays for COBRA.
Right.
You know, except the person who's paying for it.
Right. That's what I was wondering, if there's any real cost to the employer.
Well, the employer is supposed to get that extra 2% so that they can continue to administer your health insurance for you.
Mm.
So really, nobody put up extra dollars for COBRA. And I would have to say that we got to get realistic about the fact that any solution is going to cost money. So if somebody offers you a solution that's free, check it out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks
You're welcome.
For the call.
Okay.
We have about 2 minutes left and one more caller I'll squeeze in if we can try to be rather quick. Someone in Mattoon on line number two. Good morning.
I'm thinking maybe I'm overinsured. I went years without insurance, and I just did scheduled maintenance, found a nice doctor, always had a clean bill of health. Changed jobs, changed locations, got insurance, which costs, you know, still $150 a month. All of a sudden, then I needed this pill for this, and then that caused stomach problems, need another pill, cost me $30 a month in pills, and then insurance. And if I cut my insurance, will I become completely healthy again?
Not sure we can answer that.
Well, I would say that if you did that, that would be a first for the books. And I wish you luck. And I know that inexorably, because I'm in that age group myself, as we get a little older, the number of pills in your stack starts getting a little bit larger, and we got to keep that in mind.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. Well, just, you know, as a way of wrapping up, I want to emphasize again about the report. The approach you take is essentially to lay out five principles for what health insurance should, you know, features that it should have: universality, continuous care, three other points you make, and then you lay out four prototypes of different solutions and sort of compare how they would, those solutions would meet or not meet those principles.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very useful way to go about thinking about this.
Thank you very much. We worked very hard to figure out a way that would allow us to make a contribution without sort of saying we have the answer, because we really don't believe that we do. I just want to suggest that if your callers are interested, that they can go on a website for the Institute of Medicine, www.iom.edu/uninsurance, and you should get to the committee's website, and there's an enormous amount of information there if you're interested.
Good, and we'll also put a link to your website, if that's okay, on our website where we archive this interview.
Terrific.
So people can also look there and get to it quite easily. We're out of time, so we'll have to stop. There's much more we could talk about, but I'm sure we will take this subject up again in the future. And our guest has been for this hour, Shoshana Sofair, her last name S-O-F-A-E-R. She's professor of healthcare policy, School of Public Affairs, Baruch College, City University of New York, and member of the Committee on the Consequences of Uninsurance, Institute of Medicine, a part of the National Academies. And Dr. Sofair, thanks so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.